Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy.
Yeah, can we do the Chef's Challenge first, Tony?
Oh, no.
All right. Okay.
Well, mine is so
I'm
nice.
I'm so excited.
And so sweet.
Yeah.
Anyway, this week on Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine, Cindy is going to be trendy.
Because, you know, I am so trendy.
No, we wanted to have
Actually,
we wanted to have a discussion of trends.
How many times have writers asked us what the new trend is going to be? That is a question that writers have been asking us since like the beginning of anyone asking us a question.
The journalists always want to know what the trend is. I always respond, and maybe they think I'm a jerk responding this way, but and I probably am, Lord knows. What you hope is that someone's going to come from a creativity, you know, have the creativity spring from a place of truth. Once something is a trend, you're chasing it. You know, you're not being honest with yourself.
Well, that's it. I mean, I think as a restaurateur, whether you're in the front of the house or the back of the house, it's always what are your priorities. It's not what's in or what's a trend. You know, it should be about your business and what you think is right for your business.
People may
just
love,
like all businesses, basically. What's going to make your business work?
People may love chicken more. They may love chicken less. But if I open Uncle Tony's House of Chicken, there better be chicken on the menu, and I better love cooking it.
Exactly. Right, right.
So,
but the fact is that there have been trends, and there always will be trends.
It's really interesting to look back.
It's kind of fun to reflect on what they were, though. Yes.
But to guess at it or to...
What's coming up, right?
Yeah. I think you have to do the work, and then the market sets up things that are trends. I mean, that's...
Mm-hmm.
Someone watches... You should be watching the market, not us, to see what the trend is.
Sure.
So, when I was a kid... My grandmother, who I love very, very much, would go through little periods of trying to control her weight. And so Weight Watchers existed.
Right.
And so that was a thing.
And
then there were low-cal, like, frozen foods.
Okay.
That was a thing. I was trying to think of what are the things that I kind of...
What you remember
from... What are the first things that I recall being a thing? And she loved food, and she wanted to still enjoy food but control it. Because she hated the other things that were a big trend then were, and maybe they still are, but cottage cheese and fruit.
Oh, yeah, my dad ate a lot of cottage cheese when I was a little girl. Yeah.
And grapefruits.
I remember the grapefruit. Wasn't there a grapefruit diet? But I don't think that was that long ago.
Yeah, I mean, I recall watching an episode of Mad Men, actually. It's somewhere set in 67, 68.
Uh-huh.
And... one of the characters called hotel room service, obviously watching her figure, asked for a grapefruit and a pot of coffee for their breakfast.
Okay.
Sounds like
that's
a
funny.
Bitter morning.
Right. I was going to say coffee and grapefruit. That's a scary combination.
But, and then.
Bitter morning.
And then there was a cabbage soup diet that kind of ran through the world.
No. Well, that, yeah. Anyway.
That just seems like a bad outcome
for
everybody.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a very nice thing. Or fun to eat a lot of. I remember, you know, sort of the change from canned food to frozen food, because the frozen food, you know, I think
was thought to be,
you know, healthier.
Perception was better, fresher.
Yeah, right. And I also remember, you know, like the sodas back when we were kids, like Tab, which, that's, you know, my dad drank Tab. I wouldn't touch it.
My grandmother drank Fresca.
Oh, yeah. But that was, I liked Fresca.
Fresca. Popular cocktail was rum and Tab.
Ew.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Oh, what were some of the popular cocktails back in the day?
I mean, when I first worked behind a bar, it was a lot of the things that you would expect. It's a scotch and soda or a gin and tonic and martinis, Manhattans, much less specific than they are nowadays, which is kind of funny. But then you get the request for the oddball, trendy drinks of different periods of time, a Mai Tai, or a Planner's Punch.
Punch was a big thing. Isn't that what most people had at parties, like at holiday parties and things? There would be a punch. Or were mimosas big back then, too? Or
mimosas,
was that...
I can't think of a time when mimosas were not a thing.
Okay, all right. Mimosas, yeah.
Bloody Marys.
Bloody Marys,
Bloody
yeah.
Marys with a fancy garnish was definitely a thing.
Mm-hmm.
If there was brunch going on, it was
which
always...
also makes you think of shrimp cocktail, because I remember when I was a kid, like crab cocktail, shrimp cocktail, all those things were just such a big stone crab claws, all those things
first
were
place,
huge.
First place I worked, the Bloody Marys were garnished with pickled shrimp.
Yum. That sounds good though. That would be fun. Well, and didn't the waiters, I mean, the waiters all wore tuxedos back then.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, they did for many years.
Well, there's been in restaurants, there's big change as far as attire or environments.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that I sort of watch happen over time, it's interesting. Just some of the, like choice. Just there's a certain amount of, all the rules are gone in restaurants and at mealtime, right? So your choice is broad.
Right, right.
And you can cross cultures, no big deal. It wasn't like you're making tacos, but you can't use Asian ingredients. I mean, it was an exotic thing when I was a kid to make tacos or frankly,
super exotic.
Yeah, and having pasta, like jarred tomato sauce and dried pasta from, you know, some total bulk producer was
Chef Boyardee.
That was kind of a treat night, and Chef Boyardee.
Well, that's the thing. I remember when you say treat night, I remember when Mom would make a Chef Boyardee pizza, and that was a total treat because my mom was always all about the whole, you know, several vegetables, starch, meat on the plate, and we always had, you know, salads and things, and my mom really tried to make sure we ate in a healthy manner, and it was like a great joy when we got to have pizza. It was so much fun. But I also remember my mom talking about, because at one point before my father passed away, years before my father passed away, my mom and dad were visiting at one of the houses where I lived. And I was asking both of them about the history of our family and food. And my mom was talking about how she remembered the first time my eldest sister went over to one of the neighbor's houses and had pasta for dinner. And she came back and told Mom all about it. And my parents had never, you know, really eaten that before. And that's hard to believe. I mean, my sister was 11 years older than me, but really, I mean, that couldn't have been that long ago. It was in the 50s, probably, maybe the early 60s. And I'm like, wow, you didn't have pasta?
but was in York County, Pennsylvania.
Well, and
right,
that's so. It. My mom and dad are from York. And, you know, they absolutely grew up on traditional Pennsylvania Dutch cooking. And, you know, I guess, you know, the restaurants, I don't think they went to restaurants growing. Well, certainly not when they were little, because it was the Great Depression.
Immigration and emigration patterns have accelerated over time. There often were not, you know, there was not a big Italian, you know, community in
that's true.
York County,
You're
Pennsylvania.
Right. You're right. It was German.
There may be a good bit more, but yeah, that you had pretty homogenous populations in a lot of places besides larger cities.
Well, and things were pretty true to their communities. In other words, you know, you didn't have, you know, airplanes. You didn't have FedEx. You didn't have all these, you know, quick methods of getting product from all over the country either, you know.
Or all over the world.
Or all over the world, right. So, I mean, that's, to me, that's one of the biggest changes in the world of food over our lifetime is how quickly and easily we can get, pretty much as a chef, I can get any product I want, whenever I want.
Well, that's part
almost.
Of the, that's part of the
Well, at least within 24 hours.
It's part of the choice thing. I mean,
that's huge.
There are not rules and there's choice. It's interesting. In restaurants, the thing, I was thinking about it, what is the thing that broke the traditional meal structure where you have a first course and a main course, or maybe you have a soup and a salad and a main course, but we're very accustomed to that meal structure, and it still exists in some restaurants, but people don't feel, you know, beholden to it. That feel like there's one trend that changed that. I think tapas, I think the small plate trend.
Well, that's a good point. Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
That's in the 2000s, that being a big trend, I think, kind of told people, well, you don't have to have rules.
And you don't have to have big plates of food.
No,
which is so,
and you can try a lot of different things.
Was always so very American up to that point in time.
And you can share all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that very correct structure, I think that went away at that time.
Well, and also.
And people don't feel the guilt that they would feel.
Well, the advent of molecular cooking or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, while it started before 2000, it started to become extremely, people became really aware of molecular cooking with Ferran Adrià and Arzak.
I feel like a lot of that was just a blip, though. When you look back at it historically, I mean, I don't think that there was any, has that affected the rest of the culture or the way that food is consumed?
I don't think it's completely affected it, but I think it has affected it because it's being taught in culinary schools, which means that all the kids that go out to work have now had some small bit of education about it. And there is enough of a change in the way that people cook that I do think it's affected. But I think what it did was it opened a door. It opened a door more than a window into how people cook and how people also perceive food. When you talk about tapa making it, you know, helping people to realize, yeah, you know, not all your food isn't going to come at one time on the table. If you ordered a bunch of tapas, you may get these two tapas first, and then you may get three more later as it's cooking, because these two first things are cold and the other stuff's going to just, food's just going to come out. That's very unusual for Americans. They're not used to that. You know that.
That was a giant change. And the fact that people can choose to make things happen at what times, I think all of that transfers over to home, too, the choice business. I think that traditionally, when I was a kid, when you were a kid, there was certain types of food you would have at different meals.
Sure.
You would likely not have a sandwich for dinner, right?
No. If we did, it was a total treat or somebody was sick or something. I mean, yeah, exactly. You're absolutely right.
You know, the whole breakfast for dinner thing, whoever heard of
that? There
were
a whole lot
of
rules.
There's structure.
There's structure.
Yeah,
maybe
rules
is the wrong word.
A lot of that has gone away.
Mm-hmm. People sitting around the table having dinner together has also gone away. And that also has had, you know, you and I are kind of talking about trends in restaurants, but the trend in home eating, oh my goodness.
Well, they always connect.
The change, of course. The change, well, and also what's in the grocery store. That also connects. You know, what actually is available to the American public in the grocery. If they can see it in the grocery, they're definitely going to demand it in a restaurant.
Well, the single biggest difference in what's available in grocery stores is the sheer amount of prepared food.
Yeah, that's true.
There's an incredible amount of prepared food.
Right. And it's probably better than it used to be, too. I mean, not only is there more of it, but I don't know, but I would suspect that it's better than it used to be. Because both partners in the family are working to support the household. And then, you know, there's just not time to either make a big dinner so you eat prepared food, or you go out to eat, or thank God, or you are cooking at home, but it's probably pretty quick, or you're making something that now we have a new thing that's happening, which is food's being, you know, delivered to your house, and you're, oh, look, there's a recipe that comes with this, and now I chop this a little bit and I put it together. I mean, that's a whole new ball game. So the home is definitely changing and has been changing for years.
It's just layered. It's all the different places that we eat. So those habits, those attitudes, you know, it's very interesting to see what's happened. The other thing that I would say connected to choice is choosing, I guess, a little bit back to my grandmother and her, mm-hmm. her diets. The choosing, and we'll get more into this in the second segment, choosing exactly what it is you're going to eat and being okay with making choices that are not the choices that everyone else makes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel I'm just old enough to feel a little bit of guilt from the other evening. Nobody wanted to cook at home. I was going to be home for dinner. I went out to get food for wife and daughter, and I stopped at a different place to get food for myself.
I was waiting to hear what you were going to say.
Yeah. Because I wanted different stuff.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And there are different dietary requirements of
sure.
some of the parties, so it wouldn't have occurred to me to even do that.
Sure, I get it.
Maybe even 10 years ago. But I think the choice thing is a huge driver in the culture.
Definitely. I'm with you.
So,
I get it.
When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll get a little further into trends, try to take a deep dive into vegetarian cooking and vegetarian food, and all of the food allergies and limitations and choices that people make. All of that and more on WYPR. Thank you. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
We're talking about trends and the changing dinner table and the change of food consumption in our lives, at least in our lifetime. So, Cindy, what do you eat now that you did not eat in 1975, 1985, 1995?
Well, you know, for me, what immediately comes to mind is seafood because of what's available now. It's so different. And also, I mean, I did grow up at that part of my life. I was, you know, moving from North Carolina to northern Indiana. And in Indiana, there's just was almost no seafood available in the markets for my mom. But, you know,
You were eating local, right? You're eating
We ate a lot of beef. And I mean, Indiana, oh my goodness, you know, we had tons of great vegetables and all sorts of seasonal. And really between, we were so close to the Michigan border, we were 7 miles from Michigan, that we would go up and pick strawberries in the summertime and blackberries. And, you know, my mom was old fashioned. I mean, she believed in all of those wonderful things. And she, of course, made preserves and jams and, you know, froze things and did all kinds of things to try and have healthy food for the family all year long. And I think also, you know, probably having grown up during the Great Depression, that, you know, they were very careful about everything that they bought and how everything was used and used completely and carefully thought out and never overpurchased. And I mean, they were just very thoughtful about the way they handled their food. And of course, you know, my dad would make corned beef or would make a corned beef hash and things, you know, that he would still grind himself. He had a meat grinder that attached to the countertop and, you know, just would do it by hand. And I grew up with all of those things. And we ate very well growing up, but oftentimes it was very simple cooking and not expensive at all. So I think also for me, the things that have changed is I've been exposed to more because of having traveled to Europe as much as I have and getting to see things that I would not have seen. Now, I don't know that that has anything to do with the trend.
Yeah, it speaks to the seafood. If it was frozen fish sticks, that was not something you liked.
No, I hated them. Okay. I hated fish when
But I
was a
know
kid.
That you love beautiful fish
I
well
do.
Prepared.
Love it. Love it. Love
so
it.
So what's the difference? The difference is seafood getting, you know, transportation around. Mm-hmm. The country. I mean, that's a simple giant change.
Well, and who would think that now I buy most of my seafood coming in through New York? And, you know, you wouldn't think that. You wouldn't think that that would be, you know, it's either coming through Baltimore or it's coming through New York, and maybe some of it comes through the port of Charleston. But, you know, it's coming from all over the world. And it is amazing what the access that we have to food product.
Well, and the speed of distribution.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, my dad also did that. At the end of his career, he was one of the first people to import lamb into the United States from New Zealand. And that was because, you know, we lived in Charleston.
We're talking about this for us, but I think we'd be very interested if listeners wanted to share anything about what's changed with their dinner table, what's changed in their lifetime about how food works, and also maybe what do you like now that you didn't remotely like 30 years ago, 50 years ago?
Or what do you find that's more accessible than it used to be? You know, just how has your life changed? I would love to hear people's stories about that.
Yeah, it'd be very, very interesting. And remember, you can email us, foremanwolf@wypr.org, and you can, of course, look up this program or any other program. Find the podcast on the WYPR website, wypr.org. So have you ever gone through a period of time where you ate just only vegetarian cooking?
No, but I will say that for sure in my life, I eat a lot less meat than I used to. I mean, there's no question. But I also have an unusual day. You know, while I am surrounded by food all day long, I don't really eat that much food. I may take, you know, I obviously taste throughout the day, but my time goes by too fast. Sometimes I'll leave the house without breakfast. I won't eat lunch. And the first time I eat is employee meal, which is hard to believe.
Let me get your mother on the phone.
Yeah, right. Well, and I think in reflecting on that, I mean, again, vegetables are so available and I love them now. So I definitely eat a lot more vegetables than I used to. I mean, I will sit down if we have fresh cauliflower that just came in from the farm like we are right now. I will sit down and eat a bowl of cauliflower for dinner with a little bit of olive oil and salt on it. Or I might have a little bit of butter on it. It just depends. And that I would never have thought to eat that way in the past. Oftentimes I'll just eat a big salad. I love everyone in my family. We love big salads. I mean, and And I will also say, when I travel to Europe, all these wonderful dishes that I'm eating, at some point, I just begin to crave a great green salad. And, you know, it just, it makes you feel good. It helps your body. It does all the things that you want it to do. And it's refreshing and crunchy. So, yeah, I love vegetables.
I ask because it's one of those things that we've watched it change. That's, to me, that's got to be the single biggest change over the past, what would you say, 25 years?
Definitely.
In people's diets, just watching it from restaurants. But you can also see it in stores, because to produce worthwhile vegetarian food, vegetarian courses, often vegan, that's something that if I had come to you when Savannah opened.
Okay.
And said, I thought we should have 4 courses on the menu that were all vegetarian courses.
I would have been really surprised and confused. I mean, truly, I would never have thought to do that then, because there was no demand. People didn't go out to eat a plate of vegetables. They didn't.
That's first place I saw.
Just an open statement. It's the truth. Yeah. You know, it's just the way things were.
The first place I saw or heard of a menu that was only vegetables, I mean, there's the famous restaurant in Paris,
Arpège. Yeah, yeah.
Arpège.
I remember that. That was a big deal when he just started serving only vegetables. That was like a big, it was almost like a controversy in the food world.
It was a giant
controversy. It was crazy. Everybody was like, what is he doing? Not me, but I mean, a lot of people were really surprised by that.
Now he serves a lot of vegetables.
And a lot of money.
Maybe a nice piece of lamb. A lot of vegetables.
He is a great chef.
Jean Dory, you know.
Right. His plates are, he's a great chef, and good for him, you know? But yeah, you're absolutely right. When we opened Savannah, I would never have put 4 vegetable courses on, because I would have known that back then, which would have been, what, 96, that we wouldn't have sold them. They wouldn't have sold. I would have put all that work into something, and it would not have, we might have sold one.
And that's
now,
the thing is,
now we would sell 18, 20, 22 on a night where we do 80 people. That, or maybe 100 people. Let me say that again.
But probably you put a tremendous amount of work in now to making vegetable courses very interesting. And
absolutely.
You know, it's in another place, the vegetarian plate that we make to sort of create a simple, hearty meal is always one of the most popular things on the menu.
Sure, sure.
It's an interesting, you wouldn't have done the work 25 years ago. Because you knew it would just be a waste.
It would have been a waste.
So the change has been entirely market driven.
It's amazing, and also I remember some of the first times I made vegetarian plates of food for vegetarians, and people would come up and say something to me. They were amazed that it was so thoughtful or that it was so good. And I think, you know, probably, you know, I don't know, what do you want to say, 18 years ago, 17, 16 years ago, Tony. You know, if you went to have a vegetarian plate, it was probably a whole bunch of vegetables just thrown together. And there was a time where French chefs would get mad at you if you asked for a plate of vegetables or told them you were vegetarians.
There are times when it's still right now.
Yeah. But I mean, that's just how things have changed. And I mean, I've been cooking for 30 years, a little more than that. And that's a huge change. It's interesting.
Yeah. I think that's the single biggest one.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the choice, I think, and vegetarian as a content change. I think those are the two biggest ones. So the interesting thing to me is that people, they ask because they're very interested in their health. They're
sure.
Very interested in their diet. The amount of food focus that there is in the culture is enormously higher. Whether that's, you know, I don't think it's remotely driven by food television, but food interest in the culture. I do think that contributes to it. Being surrounded by it, awareness of it, and more meals away from the home means that people are pitching specific foods all the time. And I think that affects the way people choose things and the way that they request things. And that's just been an interesting cultural adjustment.
Yeah, it's all good. I mean, it's an exciting time in our world with food. I appreciate all the influences and the open-mindedness of people eating and how excited they can get about different cultures. And it's just fun. For me as a chef.
The fact that people are so engaged. I mean, I hope that we do everything perfectly. I hope that we do everything the way that people want. But it speaks to the level of engagement people have with the dishes, very specifically, that are landing in front of them. And I think that's not, we're not as focused on that 20 years ago?
No, and I think, well, people are more knowledgeable about food cooking because of, you were saying, about the Food Network. You know, it's just, it's right there. They can watch it 24 hours a day. So it is easy for people to, you know, learning to cook is all about experience of cooking and eating. So the more you can see a visual aid, whether it's on the Food Network or on the internet or something, the better you are at buying, at prepping, and actually the execution and the cooking of the product. So I think that that's been a huge change in people's perception of food and what they want from a restaurant and what they want from their grocery store and what they expect to do with their family at mealtime.
Well, I think, and people are much more adventurous at home. They feel like if they've seen the visual aids and they've gotten the details and they've compared, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 different variations of the preparation, they feel like they're gonna nail it.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I know has changed is what kind of pots and pans people buy. I mean, think about, okay, I will use the word Farberware. My mother had Farberware when I was a kid. She still has those pots and pans. Eventually, she asked me to get her a couple like I have at home. And, you know, maybe one of those knives you have, Cindy. And, you know, that has changed. I mean, you know, it was always, you had your Pyrex dishes, your Farberware, your, you know, all these things that were very normal for the home. And now people, you know, we have all these great cooking stores and you can buy anything you want. And of course, on the internet, you can buy anything you want for your house. I mean, imagine, you know, your Pennsylvania Dutch mother having a gnocchi board at home. Well, that wouldn't have happened.
What are two or three trends? What are two or three words that just whatever pops into your head of the last 25, 30 years?
Harvest date on something like olive oil immediately. I mean, I don't know if that's a trend, but I mean, things
it's
like that,
deal.
It's another thing that it's an awareness. You know, people are aware now that you can't have your spices in your cupboard for the last, I mean, literally, again, I know we had, I'm sure we had spices like everybody else for years. You know, oh, I need that one thing, but, you know, they, all these
things.
There
was definitely dried basil in my mother's cabinet from 1971. Until 1983.
Right. And Lowry's, you know, I mean, like, just different.
Oh,
yeah.
Lowry's
seasoning salt. I mean, all that stuff, you know, and that's, I mean, to me, that's an impact. That's a really positive impact.
Words that pop out, that's funny, the three words that pop out to me right this moment, artisanal.
Yeah.
How often did you hear the word artisanal a decade ago?
Never.
You know, I recall doing or telling people we had an artisanal cheese cart in a restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And it was this incredibly novel thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But at the moment, everyone wants artisanal
everything. Oh, my
everything.
Gosh. That's another thing that's changed dramatically.
So that's one.
It's the world of cheese.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, the U.S. is really good at
Woo!
Cheese now.
Yeah, we are making some really good cheese. It's super exciting.
15 years ago, it was not.
Nah. Uh-uh.
So, sorry, American.
What were your other words?
Local.
Oh, really? Yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
I mean, it's in every single commercial now. You know, it's artisan and local are in every single food commercial from every single chain in the country, which tells me that we're about to go through more changes.
Yeah, right.
So, I'm going to do to you what you said the writers would do to us. What do you think the next change is going to be?
Oh, boy.
Is it going to be only like, you know, farm your own stuff and cook the stuff that you grow? There's a little bit of that around the country. They're definitely one of my favorite restaurants, and I think you like it very much, too. In Italy, that's what they do. And the menu can be very brief, and the menu can be long, depending upon what they have. And the meat is what they killed.
Yeah.
So that's the one I would propose.
You sort of suggested, I think that all things come full circle. So I believe that we will continue to really buy locally because we are environmentally challenged at this time and will be probably for a long time. And we need to be conscious of that. So I think that the local farming will continue to move forward and that the markets, the wonderful markets that we have in the summer and spring and fall, will continue to grow and blossom, and that they will be popular. I hope that the trend will be that people will start to cook a little bit more at home. I personally want people to have that time at home, that family time. I think it's unbelievably important. The phones need to be put down. People need to talk to each other. I'm so afraid that these kids are going to grow up and they're not going to be able to communicate. And their interaction is going to be really limited. So I think that it has to come full circle. We have to be back at the table. I think it will be important for families to cook together. You know, it's no longer going to be mom cooking, obviously, and doing all the work. So therefore, it's mom and dad, or mom and mom, and dad, whatever the situation is. And I think that time is so important. So I hope that that's coming. And I think accessibility locally will help to really bring that along, and accessibility to looking at something on the internet and learning how to do it together. And you think about Julia Child and those cooking shows that she used to do. And, you know, that was so influential. I know people used to watch her show and cook along with her, or they would certainly take notes or buy her cookbook or whatever. But you had that visual of her tackling things in a very everyday sort of way. She was not a great chef. She was a great chef, but she wasn't a great chef. You know what I mean?
She was a much greater enthusiast and communicator than she was a chef.
Right. And she just was so good at making mistakes and making her cooking so real that it inspired people to be brave. And I challenge people to do that. I challenge you to be brave and just tackle something you're not used to. I mean, there's all these resources now. You can figure it out. Do it. Or just try it on your own and try and figure it out, because that's what cooking is all about. So going to the grocery store and not buying the same old thing, or going to market and not buying the same old thing, but branching out. And I think that's the future. I don't know if that's a trend, but I think it's the future of cooking. And I think that the molecular thing will start to, you know, it's already started to filter down. It's filtering out and down a little bit. So I think also, you know, sort of a reflection on some of the traditional ways of cooking will come back as well.
When we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food and Wine, we've got a few more minutes on trends and what has happened, what will happen, and maybe some beverage. And, of course, the kindest, sweetest, most reasonable chef's challenge that Chef Cindy Wolf has ever seen.
I can't wait, Tony.
All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
So we've been talking about food trends. We've been talking about the changes in the culture. We've been talking about the broad choice, the changes in transportation, all the things that have gigantically impacted how we eat in this country, whether it's at home, out in restaurants. And so we're getting to the really good part.
Wine?
Yeah, wine or beverage.
Beverage.
All beverage.
Well, I was thinking, kind of jumping
we
back to
wine.
The beginning of the conversation, which is, so back in like the 60s, what was the grape varietal? Or did they even talk about grape varietals?
No, there was no grape varietal.
They didn't say, oh, I want a Chardonnay. I want a Merlot.
I was talking to a close friend who's 20 years older than me.
Okay.
And he's talking about this case of first growth Bordeaux that he bought for $7 a bottle.
Oh, my gosh.
From a B-plus vintage.
Did he give you some?
That he drank all of.
Oh, okay.
In a couple of years in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It was very economically reasonable to drink a French wine.
Sure.
So they drank a lot of French wine. And a few people drank Italian wine. And if they weren't drinking wine, and there were not that many drinking that much wine, the demand was not that high. They drank a lot of spirits and beer.
Okay. I didn't think about that. So people didn't drink a lot of wine in the 60s or 70s?
No, they drank cocktails.
Okay.
You'd have to be someone trying to live a European lifestyle.
Okay.
In order to drink
wine.
You know,
I grew up in a household where there was almost no drinking. So I wouldn't know. And then
I grew up in a household where there was a lot of drinking. They were good at it.
Oh boy. Uh huh.
That's my mother saw this fellow.
Oh God.
After my parents split, who was from former Yugoslavia. He was a pathologist, and he drank great wine, and he liked to come and visit. So he kept a case of 1960 Chateau Latour, the first growth Bordeaux, just put it down in the basement so he could get a glass of something decent when he came by.
Wow, fun.
Yeah.
That's cool.
The first dry red wine that I had a taste of was 1960 Chateau Latour.
It's a good place to start.
That's a pretty good, again, a really nice B-plus vintage.
So what about in the 80s? What happens with wine in the 80s?
Well, 70s is wine's growth. I mean, that's
okay.
That's when the Paris tasting and the big, you know, showdown of American wines versus and French wines. And
yeah.
And as soon as there was American wine that was interesting, supposed to be high quality, still accessible price-wise, then people started drinking wine. And they started identifying it by varietal, a lot easier than remembering the names of chateaus or bodegas or whatever the wine producer was in the world. It was just like, oh, it's Merlot from John Smith. That's what it became. It became much, much more wine consumption once that tasting happened in the 70s. And through the 80s, that increased. The 80s was the decade of what varietal is hot, what varietal is interesting. And it's interesting what varietals have stuck and which varietals haven't.
So which have?
Chardonnay never goes away.
Right.
Cabernet Sauvignon never goes away. That being said, now the consumption, just watching on the retail side, now the consumption is much broader and much more adventurous than it's ever been. In the last 7 or so years, that growth and that boldness and willingness to be adventurous in wine choices parallels exactly the growth in individual spirits, small batch spirits, artisanal cocktails, all the local brewing and local beers. And so that's a giant trend in beverage all at one time. It's not we're consuming more of this and less of this and more of that and less of that. Our attitude has changed about all of those things.
Yeah. It's like cheese. We sort of talked for a moment about cheese. It's so exciting what's going on in our country because, you know,
it always comes back to cheese with you.
In a way. But yeah, I mean, between artisanal beers and all these great, you know, cheese producers.
Well, people are better at stuff. I mean, that's there's a little brewery that does a great job that we get stuff from every day or two that's just like fresh and terrific. And, you know, we use that in one of the places.
Yeah, who would have thought that was going to happen 20 some years ago?
No, because it was purely the Bud truck rolling up. That's kind of remarkable.
So what do you think, Tony, what do you think the next trend is in drinks?
Oh, I don't appreciate you turning that table.
I know it's not your...
In wine, the thing that... Wine's a little bit easier to track. The trend is always towards higher quality, and the trend is always towards being fairly priced. I mean, that's an easy one. The more that people start to trust their own palates and they have more and more, then the more diverse the products are that they choose and that they're willing to try. And one of the things that's happened with wine over time is people will talk about how they like something that's big, and red wine, something that's big and rich. Something that's, you know, really palate drying and tannic and purple and inky in the glass and this sort of thing. I think that people have finally gotten enough confidence in the U.S. to know that there are times for that and there are times for things that are not as dense as that and that still have a ton of expression. So I think we may finally dial back a little bit some of the alcohol in some of those giant reds and have something a little more balanced and a little more moderated, honestly, that actually matches the diet that people are eating a lot more. There is less meat being consumed, but really good stuff. There's more fish and more vegetables being consumed. It's reasonable that people will figure out, just like they figured out over X number of centuries in different places in France or Italy, what I'm going to grow grape-wise in this area that makes sense for the climate is probably, you know, we're going to figure out how to make that so that it makes sense with the cooking that's up this area.
That's
We're in that process in the U.S., and just like everything else, we're doing it fast.
That's cool.
Doing it fast is the theme of this Chef's Challenge, should you choose to accept.
You know, I always do my Chef's Challenge.
Oh, I know. You're the speediest.
You're the slow one.
I am a slow one.
All right.
I like to relish it, savor it.
You're going first.
I am definitely not going
first.
I'll go first. Cipollini, porcini, swordfish, Nicoise olives, baguette, olive oil. That all sounds like a good sandwich to me. I'm a sandwich guy.
I know.
Olive oil, garlic, rosemary, la bomba rice, zucchini, something crossed off the list, red romaine, haricot vert, also known as little skinny French string beans, walnut 012.
Oil.
Walnut oil. I like walnut 012. That's really
that doesn't sound like a real thing to me.
That's really artisanal. Walnuts are numbered. I'd like walnut number 84, please. Roasted tomatoes. Are these my
I almost said sun-dried tomatoes just for fun to take you way back to the 1980s.
That's a 1982 trend right there.
Yeah, I almost said it. I'm like, nobody wants to know
what
to do with sun-dried tomatoes.
Shrimp. You always give me a lot of proteins. All right.
Well, I don't think I've ever given you shrimp, so that occurred to me.
You don't, you know I don't particularly love shrimp. So
how can you not like shrimp?
I don't. That's. Can I have some vinegar, please?
Yes.
All right. And some sugar?
Yes.
See, I want to pickle the shrimp.
You have a pantry.
Oh, that's lovely. Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
I want to do a pretty garlicky pickle of those shrimp. That's one. And have them as a garnish with it. That red romaine, I want to grill that. And dress it with a vinaigrette with the roasted tomatoes and garnish it with the pickled shrimp.
Okay.
So that's one. The la bomba rice, we're going to make the rice with the cipollini, the porcini, more of that garlic, some shallots if I can have them. And I need stock. I can make it with water. Make it vegan.
You don't have any stock.
Okay, no stock, so I'll make it vegan, which means I've got to make a really good mushroom stock first. It's going to take some time. It's going to take a long, slow time, Cindy. But, yeah, you have...
Well, I hope there's a lot of wine to drink while this cooking goes
on. That's okay with
me. It's going to take forever.
Yeah, and I drink wine slowly,
and there's going to be some seriously dirty pans when you're done. I know this for a fact. Yes.
Yep. I clean them up. So, yeah, the cipollinis would be a nice garnish with the porcini broth or the porcini stock and with garlic and rosemary there. That's... good. That's all reasonable. So then the swordfish. Swordfish, I just want to sear it.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make a little relish out of the Nicoise olives and some of the oil. And I have those veggies to fool around with. I can just blanch the haricot vert and grill ribbons of the zucchini and toss those guys in with some of the oil and sea salt and just have simple garnishes for the swordfish. So,
sounds good.
Yeah, easy.
All right. Did you use everything?
Yes, I did.
Huh.
I did. Oh, okay. Baguette. So you eat the baguette. There we go.
Ooh, chickpeas. I love chickpeas. Chicken breasts.
They go with chickpeas.
Garlic, shallots, Brussels sprouts, onions, carrots, celery, maitake mushrooms, red potatoes, chicken stock.
I gave you stock.
Pasta, butter, cream, spice cabinet, rosemary, chicken sausage.
Yes.
Calabrian chili, sun-dried tomato. That's funny.
There you go.
That's funny. Does that say Raisin Bran and Fruit Loops? Oh,
yes,
gosh,
it does.
Tony.
Eat some breakfast.
Well,
eat some breakfast.
I'm just going to start with those sun-dried tomatoes because I
eat some breakfast first.
I haven't worked with sun-dried tomatoes in forever. And
Fruit Loops
I
are good
to,
for you.
So I'm going to start by, I'm going to cook the chicken breasts and I'm going to saute them at high heat, brown them really nicely. And finish them in the oven and let them rest. When they come out of that pan, I'm going to have the shallots, the garlic, the onion, and a very small dice ready to go. I'm going to put that in the pan so it gets all that wonderful juice from the chicken breasts and all the good fond off the bottom of the pan.
The fond is the chicken goo.
Right. And the Brussels sprouts I will have blanched off. They'll be on the side just waiting. The maitake mushrooms will hit that pan with the garlic, the shallot, and the onion, and let those begin to brown and all that goodness. Meanwhile, the red potatoes will have already been boiled off. If they're really tiny red potatoes, you can just boil them in heavily salted water, drain them, pop them back in the pot, put the lid back on it, let them steam a little bit, toss in a little bit of olive oil and let them, and salt and pepper, and let them just kind of work and wait. And once I'm ready to serve the dish, all that wonderful stuff, the garlic, the shallot, the onion, the maitake mushrooms, we'll get the potatoes. I'll quarter them. And add them to it, or if they're really small, just add them maybe in half or whole. Deglaze that pan with your chicken stock and make a little quick pan sauce. Finish it with a little bit of cream, which you gave me, which I can't believe. And I'm going to
throw... You're welcome.
This is like a one-pot dish here. I'm going to throw in that piece of rosemary at the end and just let that perfume it and pull it right back out and remove it, throw it away. So that's the chicken dish. The chickpeas... I'm going to make soup with. So you gave me Calabrian chilies, the sun-dried tomatoes, and the chicken stock. I'm absolutely making a broth with that. I haven't used my celery or my carrots yet. So that makes, and I'll use some more of the onion. So onion, celery, carrot, all in a brunoise, which is the smallest of dice. I'll work that, add the chicken sausage, which I'm assuming is a bulk sausage. In my mind, that's what it is. So I'm going to kind of allow it to brown in small pieces.
Yeah, no jackets.
And then no casing, you mean?
Yeah.
And then add the chicken stock. Let that work so that the flavor develops with the Calabrian chilies in there and the sun-dried tomato. And that is, honestly, that broth's going to be really good. And that could be good enough just to eat on its own, but then I'll throw in the chickpeas. Now, chickpeas take forever to cook. So make sure if they're dried that you've soaked them overnight in your refrigerator with lots and lots of water over, you know, so they're absolutely going to absorb all that liquid. That will really cut down on your cooking time, because I'll tell you what, chickpeas, sometimes they take 3 hours to cook. They're just horrendously long cook time, but sure worth it, because they sure do taste good and they're super inexpensive. So I'll add the chickpeas and allow it all to cook, and then I've got a soup. So that's fun. And the pasta, I don't know this shape. Tony, can you just say the word, please? I don't know what this is. Stroza.
Strozzapreti.
That. So what shape is that?
It's a garrote shape, basically.
Okay, so that's going to go in the soup at the end. So that'll be fun. Now, I've used everything except for Tony's raisin bran and Fruit Loops.
I told you, eat some breakfast.
And that's, I guess, what that is. So I'll mix the two soup cereals together.
Innovative.
Golly. That's it. That was fun.
Nice. You did that fast.
I am fast. I talk fast. I'm from, you know, that's what happens when you grow up in Indiana.
I think that's all we have time for on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. If you want to download this program, if you missed any, or you just loved it and want to listen to it again, just go for it. Or any of our other programs as a podcast, go to the WYPR website, WYPR.org, and look for the Foreman & Wolf page. If you want to email us and tell us my breakfast cereal joke is bad, or any other comments, or your comments about the changing table and nature of eating over the last several decades in the U.S., email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. If you want to follow us on social media, follow Chef Cindy Wolf.
You can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf and on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. Thanks so much for listening.
And happy Sunday.